There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Finborough Road in West Brompton, SW10. One stop west of the stabbing of Countess Lubienska. Three streets east of the last killing by the sadistic little drummer boy. And a few streets northeast of where police brutality possibly led to a suspect's amnesia. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Typical for this area, Finborough Road consists of a long line of five-storey white stone terraces, with each floor offset. So from the basement, all you can see is feet, tyres, and possibly poodle turds. And to truly infuriate the disabled, simply to get to the ground floor, you have to first ascend a set of stone steps. With no front garden, just a sharp descent down a set of hard stone steps to the basement. It's the balconies where the tenants tend to dump their crap. Whether a broken pram, a burst bouncy castle, an excess of empty booze bottles, the gym equipment that they only used once, and an oversized patio set for the one summer's day that they can sit and sup wine like they're in Venice, as they inhale the fumes of 50 trucks. But at 5:40 a.m, on Thursday the 6th of May 1948, on the basement steps of 17 Finborough Road, the broken body of 26-year-old part-time waitress and prostitute Winifred Mulholland was found. Missing for 4 days, and dead for almost one, the position of her body posed a perplexing mystery. As had she been hit by a car? Had she fallen from a height? Or had a killer dumped her in plain sight, on a busy road? But why? My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 214, The Woman in Red, Part 1. There wasn't any rhyme nor reason why Winifred Mulholland would be murdered. She lived a modest life, she had few debts, and she didn't cause any trouble, as alongside thousands of other single women struggling in the post-war era, she made the best of what she had, and she had big plans for the future. But there was a piece of her life which was missing, and this hole she filled with little white lies. Born on the 11th of July 1922, at the Elizabeth Hospital in Birtley, Gateshead, in the northeast of England, Winifred Virginia Mulholland was one of two children to Florence and James Mulholland. Raised in a poor mining community and living a hand-to-mouth existence, even though it was said by Florence and James that their marriage was not a happy one, being unable to pay for a divorce, they plodded on as best they could. Maybe this unhappy upbringing was the reason that Virginia, as she preferred to be called, would remain an eternal child, always drifting from daydream to nightmare and fleshing out her life with fantasy. Across her 26 years alive, Virginia would retain a sweetness about her. Being a dainty 5'2" tall and barely 8 stone, her fair hair was as light and airy as candy floss. Her eyes twinkled as if only innocent thoughts buzzed her brain like a bee seeking out pollen. And shining like June's on the whitest of beaches were her two apple blossom cheeks, which protruded as if a naughty word was perched on her lips. Years later, Lillian, her landlady, would state, "She was a quiet, babyish sort of girl who was very fond of dancing to my wireless at home." But Lillian didn't truly know her, as I thought she was a Canadian. Why Virginia would pretend to be a Canadian is anyone's guess, but she did. In 1936, age 14, she moved with her parents and her brother to London, seeking better work and brighter prospects. But as happened to many families, they found the pay was higher, but so were the costs. Having finished school with a basic school certificate, her options as a working-class girl were limited. And as she hadn't got the skills to become a secretary, she earned a modest wage by waitressing in cafes. And that was her life. She worked long hours to earn a pittance. She had no big plans for the future. And then she went home to witness the bickering and the sniping of her arguing parents. By 1940, being a few months into the Second World War, and at the start of an 8-month bombing campaign of British cities by the Luftwaffe, with her brother sent to boarding school, Virginia and her parents moved into a small cottage in the remote village of Wadhurst in Kent, 50 miles south of London. It should have been a place of safety, far from the bombed-out ruins of the West End. But being stuck alone with her warring parents, whose relationship was so bad that they were forced to live in separate parts of the same cottage, she often came home to more screams and explosions than she heard in the city. In 1945, with the war finally over, and a sense of normality slowly returning, as Virginia had been struck down with an unidentified gastric disease, she returned to her parents' cottage for 2 years, but then she left, only to encounter her very first brush with murder. It's an odd link, which no one has ever connected. But in 1946, Virginia worked as a waitress at the Victory Cafe at 266 Edgware Road in Paddington. For 2 years, she was employed by the cafe's manager, Alice Williams, who all of her staff would call Madam, as previously reported in episode 162. nothing could be proven. But it was suggested that although Alice supplied employment and support to many young women in a difficult situation, she was potentially also a madam who took possession of their official papers, who got the girls into sex work, and who may also have taken a cut of their earnings. But on Boxing Day 1950, just 19 months after Virginia went missing, Alice was stabbed to death in the cafe's kitchen by June McKechnie, a friend, a customer, and a prostitute, in an argument over money. It is uncertain if Alice got any of her waitresses into prostitution. But around that time, Virginia received the first of four convictions for soliciting, with the last on the 28th of January 1948, shortly before she left. That said, there is very little information about what type of prostitute she was. For Virginia, sex work wasn't a career option, but a casual habit she hopped into to supplement her very meager income. As with many women in the late 1940s, the war had provided them with job opportunities unavailable prior, which included better pay and higher skills by making munitions for the war effort. But with conscription over, and many such jobs being reserved for ex-soldiers, several forms of prostitution would fill the gap. It wasn't always sex that she provided. As being an attractive and affable young lady, she sometimes escorted men on trips to the cinema, on dates to affordable restaurants, and provided companionship like she was a surrogate girlfriend. And yes, she also gave them full sex if they wanted it, but also a grope, a fondle, some hand relief, or a little like kissing if they were that way inclined. For her services, they paid in cash, but also often with a hot meal, a warm bed, and black market items like chocolate and tights. With the rift between Virginia and her father ongoing, and being ashamed of her occupation, she kept a distance from her family in those final years, writing regularly to her mother, but rarely visiting. One of the last known addresses she was known to live at was the home of Mr. and Mrs. Evans, at a three-story terrace at 87 Winchester Road in Pimlico, where she lodged alone in a small second-floor room. It should have provided her with security, but with the Evanses treating her with suspicion, and a violent argument having erupted just shy of Christmas 1947, Virginia risked injury, poverty, and homelessness, owing to the unwanted affections of their son, who was described as a little vacant. Taking his side, Mrs. Evans threatened to do me an injury if I did not go out with him, Virginia confided in a friend. And having paid £39, £2,000 today in rent in advance, she also risked losing her money over a sad little boy. With her contract hardly worth the notepaper it was scrawled on, Virginia left her lodging quietly, but agreed to take Mrs. Evans's rabbit fur coat as payment for any monies that she had lost. This was the coat she would be found dead in, but there would be nothing to connect the Evanses to the dumping of her body. It's understandable then that around this time, she decided to move overseas and was in the process of applying to live in Canada. So determined was Virginia that she even adopted a Canadian accent, and to Mrs. Lillian Hall, the new landlady at 8 Bremer Road. Mrs. Virginia Mulholland of Ottawa, as she liked to call herself, said she was returning soon to Canada. In the last letter she sent her mother, just weeks before her death, Virginia would write, My life is hard, but I hope with God on my side, I can get through it. Only if God was watching over her, he must have blinked. Sunday the 2nd of May 1948 was an ordinary day for Virginia. At 4 p.m., Lillian would state, she left my house in Camberwell and said that she was going out. Although she didn't say where she was going, which wasn't unusual. Across her shoulder was slung a string handbag containing her purse and a small red diary, into which she noted her clients and the monies that they paid. She wore a rabbit's fur coat, with a mend on the hem that Lillian had recently repaired herself. And on her feet, she wore a pair of black, toeless sling black shoes, with red heels to match her red dress. That was the last time that Virginia was seen alive. With no known place of work, no close contact with her family, and no regular routines with friends, being the type of girl who did her own thing and could easily be gone for days, no one reported her missing. Four days later, and 4.5 miles west of Camberwell, on Thursday the 6th of May at 5:40 a.m, Albert Edward Stamp was walking to work when he cut through Finborough Road, as per usual. Strolling along the north side of the pavement, as he passed 17 Finborough Road, he spotted a stockinged foot of what he thought was a discarded mannequin, peeping out between the wrought iron railings, its toes up. Peering over, the left leg was buckled underneath, twisted at an unnatural angle, as if the hip had been dislocated or the knee had been snapped 90 degrees left. As long splashes of blood ran vertically along the length, both legs. Being the wrong size and shape, he knew it was too realistic to be a dummy. With her legs splayed over the stonework, her torso sprawled across the length of the top step, and her head hanging backwards over the lower step. Facing the basement, with her body facing skywards, either she'd been hit by a car and landed in a heap, had fallen from a height, or she'd been dumped by someone who saw her as nothing more than disposable, like rubbish chucked out with the bins. What had happened was uncertain, as maybe in a fall, her red dress had ridden up, her cami knickers were shown. To the side of her head lay a string handbag, almost as if it was a pillow to rest on, as underneath her smashed and shattered body lay her rabbit's fur coat, worn as she was last seen in it. And yet, although she was dressed to go out, the shoes were missing, but she hadn't walked barefoot. Believing this to be an accident, Albert ran to nearby St. Stephen's Hospital. At 6:30 a.m, Dr. John Higgs examined the body and certified her as dead. And at 6:40 a.m, Detective Inspector Albert Webb arrived. Speaking to the neighbours, no one knew the woman had seen her nearby, and no one had heard any suspicious sounds which could explain her injuries or how she got there. According to her details, she wasn't a resident at the house she was found in front of, and she had no known reason to be there. If she was hit by a car, where were the broken lights or the scratched paint flecks? If she had fallen from one of the balconies, how did she get into the house? And if her body had been dumped here, where was she killed? As the lack of fresh blood at the scene would prove that she hadn't died where she was found. She had no stab wounds, no bullet holes, and no obvious evidence of an impact with the car. She hadn't been dragged a considerable distance. But where she had, it hadn't happened outside. And there was no alcohol, no drugs, nor poison in her system to suggest that her demise may have been a result of a suicide. If she was murdered, her killer would most likely, according to the detectives, have dumped the body in a place she had no known association with, and usually within 1 mile of where the murder had taken place. As the longer he spent in public with the body, the more likely he is to be caught and to leave clues. It was a crime scene which didn't make much sense. She was a woman who didn't belong here, who no one had seen, with no signs of a robbery. And although her face had sustained significant injuries, if a killer had tried to hide her identity, why did he dump her with her handbag, her purse, her ID, and her diary? Inside the red diary were entries such as February the 11th. I met a client, failed to record his name, £4. And yet there was no references to the night or client in question, and no page had been torn out. But then again, maybe she only filled in her diary after she'd serviced the client and not before. And as for jewellery, although she never wore anything expensive, just cheap plastic costume pieces to highlight her look, under her body lay a single clipped earring and a bit of broken brooch. But where were the other pieces? Had someone taken them? Or were they in the place where she died? The pathologist, Dr. Donald Teer, saw the body in situ at 10 a.m. In his notes, he observed, "It was lying on its back on the upper steps leading down to the basement of 17 Finborough Road. The atmospheric temperature was 57.5 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly 13.8 degrees Celsius. The body felt cold, but rigor mortis was not detected in the jaw or the limbs." As it was unlikely that she had died where she was found, her time of death was impossible to determine, as decomposition was beginning to set in the internal organs. But as the congealed blood and the bruises were older than the decomposition, her injuries were at least 2 to 3 days old. But her possible time of death was no more than a day. With a dislocated left hip and knee, a fracture in her left lower femur, and a fracture of the fifth cervical vertebrae of the neck. These injuries were most likely as a result of a short fall, but they hadn't been the cause of the death, as it was likely that she was already dead. like robbery, rape was ruled out as a possible motive. As although her vagina contained a large quantity of white mucus, believed to be sperm, although there was a small erosion to the lining,
I found nothing inconsistent with her having had sexual intercourse prior to death.
Inside her throat,
there was extensive bruising to both sides of the tongue.
And as was apparently due to her teeth being driven into her tongue, owing to a sharp impact, with dried blood found in her trachea, it was clear that she was still breathing after the attack, which had occurred hours, if not days earlier. The autopsy confirmed that her cause of death was not due to the fall, but to the injuries to her face. 4 wounds, all swift and shocking enough to render her unconscious, and her death to be slow. Dr. Tier would state,
her cause of death was laceration to the brain, as across the center of her forehead was an irregular, lacerated wound 4 inches long, with an area of depressed fractures 1¾ inches wide from the frontal bone, which radiated back into the roof of the eyes and the nose.
Using a heavy blunt object, she'd been hit hard over the head with an object made of steel or iron. And being of an irregular shape and surface, it had caved in her skull, sending sharp shards of bone into her brain. Owing to the force, this injury was unlikely to have been an accident or as a result of the fall, as owing to free-flowing blood from the wound, she was alive and her heart was still beating when she was attacked. This swift and sudden impact resulted in rapid unconsciousness and a slow and agonizing death, which almost certainly paralyzed her entire body in seconds. Only her assailant's attack was far from finished. Upon what was described as her once apple blossom cheeks, a series of semicircular abrasions, with one on the right cheek and 2 on the left, had left distinct circular marks. Being of even size and slightly octagonal, she'd been struck 3 times with a hammer across the face, as the bones had fractured across the bridge of her nose, down to her chin, and right into the depths of her eye sockets. All of these injuries had occurred while she was still alive, but everything else was post-mortem, including the superficial abrasions to her knuckles on her left hand, and a laceration to her nose, which may have occurred when she was dragged from where she had died to where she would eventually be dumped. And with the fractures of the 5th vertebrae of the neck, a dislocated hip, knee, and a smaller fracture to the lower left thigh bone, all were post-mortem injuries, resulting from at least a 15-foot fall. The autopsy asked more questions than it answered, such as where had she died? Why was her body dumped here? Who had attacked her? And why? And if she was attacked on Saturday the 2nd of May, and she wasn't found until Thursday the 6th, what happened to her for the 4 days in between? All of the tenants at 17 Finborough Road aided the police as best they could with the investigation, and each provided witness statements into what they had seen and heard prior to the body's discovery. They were John Eldred, a docker who lived in the basement, George Ayton, an engineer who lived on first, Jenna Kubert, a toolmaker who lived with his wife on the second, and Dr. Wallace, a female GP, on the third. Police also spoke to all of her family members, her closest friends, her landlady Lillian Hall, as well as her former employer, Alice Williams of the Victory Cafe. And Mr. and Mrs. Evans and their slightly vacant son, whose coat Virginia was wearing. Only there didn't seem to be an immediate reason why anyone would want her dead. She wasn't a bad person. She didn't blackmail anyone. And her only real secret was her desire to move to Canada. The murderer of Winifred Virginia Mulholland would prove to be one of the most baffling cases that the police had ever encountered, on the surface at least. And yet they would have this case wrapped up and a prime suspect in custody by the end of the day, with every piece of evidence proving conclusive. But this would be a turning point for many of the investigating officers, as the murder itself would go against everything they had known about murderers and their motives. As although they believed that her killer was at least a mile away, all the while, he was watching them and listening to every word. The concluding part of The Woman in Red continues next week.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Oh, there we go, folks. Oh, cripes. Hat off. There you go. Oh, dear. Whoa. I'd just finished editing EP 213. Because obviously all these were... Welcome to Extra Mile. Unscripted, unedited, blah, blah, blah. Because I'd written these all in sequence, because while I couldn't talk, I thought, I'll write, which turned out well, because I've just finished literally editing 213, and because it's mid-afternoon, I've been to the cafe and I've charged up my laptop, I thought, you know what, bollocks to it, I'm going to record 214. So this is an evening record, so I probably won't have a cup of tea because it's a bit too late for me, and I want my din-dins. But you know what, oh dear, people who listen to Walk With Me will know this, because I recorded it for last week's episode. So this isn't a spoiler, they've already heard it. But When I was recording Walk With Me, I was talking about last week's episode, and I went into the bakery. It was 2:30. They're normally shut by this point. They were still open. I thought, oh, I'll peep in. Oh, and I looked in, and they didn't have any Belgian buns, and they didn't have any Bakewell tarts, but they had some school cake. Oh, school cake. If you're from overseas, you won't know what it is, but in Britain, when we used to have our school dinners, and they weren't particularly good, but you'd have especially if you grew up. I think I was lucky because the 1990s apparently is when all the food went really shit. I think we were in the era where there were still not too bad school dinners. And oh, school cake was one of it. Oh, a nice little sponge with some icing on top and some hundreds of thousands. But the sponge is really soft and moist. Ooh, god damn it, it's good. So I went to the shop and I bought two. And I had one before I started this episode. Because I thought, you know what, bollocks, I need it. I'm just going to open the window. Unfortunately, I am in the place where the posh bastards who have little tiny pathetic little helicopters and airplanes, they leave and they fly over you and they follow the canal. It's really, 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 really fucking annoying. And they go with their crappy little aircraft, and they go, oh, look at me, I'm on my way to a business meeting, oh, I'm important, I have a little aircraft. Twats. And because they can't navigate, they use the canal as kind of a guide, because they're twats. So there we go. You'll probably hear one fly over shortly. I'm just enjoying my... Here's me saying I'm not going to have a cup of tea because it's got caffeine in it. I'm having my lime Diet Coke. I mean, go figure that one out. Anyway, it's almost Din Din's time. So almost time for Din Din's. So we'll do some quiz questions. And then we'll do some some extra stuff for the episode. It always happens because I had bronchitis and my lungs aren't 100% yet. I'm still struggling with changes in temperature. That seems to get me. So I went to go get my post the other day, and I walked in. I'm back to doing distances again. I can't do hills, but I can do distances. My lungs are all right with distances, just not hills. And I walked from the outside where it was relatively cool, and I walked into where I get my post, and the guys in there, I don't know why, they always have the heating on full blast. And I walked in, and I had a massive coughing fit, and I was just like, I'm going to have to go outside, guys, I said while coughing. And I had to stand outside the window and get them to open my PO box for me. Because I just couldn't. A massive coughing fit. Anyway, Michael, your life is so exciting, isn't it? You cough a lot, you think about Eva, and you eat cake. Well, there we go. That's pretty much it. Let's do some quiz questions. Okay. Question number one. As always, because I was ill when I wrote this, there's only 8 questions because my brain couldn't handle 10. Question number one. What was the name? What were the names of Virginia's parents? Oh, burps. That's not the name of the parents. Question number two. In what part of Gateshead... That's not the quiz question. In what part of Gateshead was she born? Don't forget, as always, I haven't edited this episode yet, so some of these questions might not appear in the episode because I may edit it out. This feels like a long episode, so I may edit some stuff out. Question number three, what height was Virginia? I almost gave away the answer then. Question number four, how far south of London was Wadhurst where she lived with her parents? Question number five, during the war, which hospital did she work at? Question number six, on what road was the Victory Cafe? Oh, connection there, very exciting. Question number seven, how many convictions did she have for soliciting? And question number eight, in what part of London did Mr. and Mrs. Evans live? Oh, you get to enjoy listening to me coughing. So I thought I might dive into the witness statements. Let me just have a look. Witness statements. Let's do the witness statements because this is a two-parter. I have written part two. That's already done. But I'm going to edit these as I go along. So we've got witness statements by John Eldred. John Eldred lived in flat A, which was the basement flat. So that's kind of an important flat, given the fact that the body was found on the steps going down to the basement. I filmed this location last week. Really interesting. I got there, filmed the road. I always do things in a kind of a distance first, then I get closer and closer. And as I was walking near 17 Finborough Road, I realised that the man, the next door neighbour to 17 Finborough Road, was on the first floor, was sitting on his balcony that I was needed to film next door to it. And I thought, oh shit. So I walked up to the building itself, holding my phone in my hand, and I filmed the entrance to the house, and then I filmed down the steps, and he was clearly watching me. And then I went across the road and thought, right, I'm just going to film what I need to, my little bits. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you can see the full video on there, or go on TikTok. There's kind of an edited version. It's just a single camera version, but if you're on if you're a Patreon subscriber, you get to see the full version. It's edited nicely and you get to see all the bits and pieces. It's nicely done, but you can see the bit that I filmed. You can see the steps, they're still as they are today. And it was really weird. I was recording this bit, and then a lady came out of the building I was filming in front of, and she said, oh, I just heard you say murder. And I was like, oh, don't worry, I'm not, it's not your house, there's not a murder here, and I'm not filming your house. And she was like, no, I'm just interested. I'm coming to the door. So she came to the door, and we had a nice chat about the murder in the house opposite, while the man, who was the next-door neighbour of 17 Finborough Road, was watching us. So I explained to her what it was, and she went, oh, I like the sound of that. Can I have you got any details about your podcast? So I gave her a card for my podcast that may be a new listener. Ooh, exciting. So there we go. So, yeah, John Eldred lived in the basement flat. He was a docker. He, in his statement, he said, on Wednesday the 5th of May, which is the night before, I returned home between 9 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. I saw nothing outside of 17 Finborough Road. If there had been a body there, I should have seen it. Obviously, because that's his only way into his home, is to step over the body to get into the basement. So there was clearly no body there the night before, and he didn't hear anything either. I might not do Dr. Donald Tears, his statement, because we used the bulk of it there. Dr. James Higgs, he was the doctor who was called. He arrived at 6:30 a.m. went to 17 Finsborough Road, saw the body was dead. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you can, I've put crime scene photos on there. They're really weird. Like, when I saw them in the, these were another one, the files that I opened up in the archives, and I looked at them and I went, oh, okay. They were meant to have been put, I was meant to have been put in the isolation room, the invigilation room, so no one can see you. And I was in the regular room, so I had to discreetly take the pictures. But it's weird when you look at how Virginia's body has been dumped on the stairs, and the way it looks, it looks posed. It looks like something that you'd expect. Like, do you know when Powell and is it Powell and Pressburger who did Peeping Tom? I think it was either one or both of them. It's got that kind of 1960s kind of weirdness to it. Of you look at it and it looks posed. It looks arty. It looks really strange when you. But yeah, it looks posed. But it almost certainly isn't. But is it? It's just weird. It's really weird. It's horrible, but yeah, weird. Albert Edward, was that one of the quiz questions? I think it was going to be one of the quiz questions. There, good. I'm glad I didn't use that. The gentleman who found the body, mosquito just landed on my arm. Luckily, it was dead. Edward Albert Stamp found the body at 5:40 a.m. He lived on Billing Road, not too far away. He was on his way to work, and he normally passed through Finborough Road. Finborough Road is kind of a main road, so it makes sense that he would walk down that route. If you go either side, you're going to go into the side road. So Finborough Road is kind of a direct route, especially if you go into Earl's Court, the tube station. He said, I found a woman in the area with part of her legs on top of the steps and her body hanging down. there were no shoes. She appeared dead, and I informed St. Stephen's Hospital. He told the porter there to call the police. At that point, he was working for London Transport. at Earl's Court Station. We've already heard from Mrs. Lillian Hall, who was her landlady. She lived at 8 Braemar Road in Brixton. It says Brixton, it's actually Camberwell. She was a housewife. She kind of ran the lodging house with her husband. She seems like a decent lady. She seemed to like Virginia. Virginia had been there a couple of weeks by that point. I may have edited it out the episode. I think my plan was to edit it out. Originally, she got on well with Virginia and Lillian got on really well together. They got to know each other. Lillian believed that she was a waitress. She said that Virginia had said that she was a waitress over in Fleet Street area, but she didn't say what the name of the cafe was. She said that she normally left the house around 6 p.m. and normally came back about 8 a.m. Sometimes she would leave earlier and go to the cinema. Sometimes she would stay away for a night or maybe two nights. She never had anyone back to the flat. And she sometimes hung around with another girl, but she didn't know the name of the other girl. And that's pretty much all she knew about her. Don't forget, she'd only been there a couple of weeks. I need to be careful with this. I won't read Detective Inspector Albert Webb's statement because that leads to too much for next week. We're going to dive. There's a lot to cover next week, so I really need to be really careful here. There's a lot that it's a fascinating case. It really is, which is why it's a two-parter. It has to be a two-parter because there's just a lot to cover. I can't do DDI Balls either. Can't do that. The Toolmaker. Zenit Kubert, he lived on the second floor with his wife Monica. I can't do that one either. Bollocks. Only because we use that next week. I've put this in, but I can't use any of that. I can't use any of it because it gives away too much for next week. It's a really interesting case. It really is. It's one of these ones where you just think, why do we know more about this case? It's absolutely fascinating. And even for the lady who lived opposite, who I was telling her about the case, I told her, I gave her a very, very quick précis of what the episode was about. She's like, oh, wow, that's interesting. And it's like, it is. I can't tell you what it's about now because it ruins a lot for next week. I think that's it. I think that's all I'm really going to be able to say. This may be a very, very short extra mile. I could just rant and ramble about shit. While we were recording this, there was a dog behind me and to the right who was barking his head off. And then there's a dog behind me far to the left who was barking his head off. And they seemed to be having a nice little conversation. Bastards, utter bastards. I love dogs, except when they're barking when I'm trying to do recording. They would be upset if they were recording a doggy podcast, wouldn't they? And I was there going, they would be absolutely furious. They'd be like, we've been trying to talk about biscuits here and walkies and leads and what's the best lead and how long you should sniff each other's arseholes for. Maybe that's what I'll do in this podcast. A conversation about sniffing arseholes. Although I have just finished listening to a podcast about Elon Musk, and he's an arsehole. So there we go. I wonder if this episode will be taken down now, because he has the power, doesn't he? He has the power to turn things off and to go, you're an arsehole, I hate you, that stops. What a twat. Right, let's do the quiz questions. Oh, healthy. Question number one. What was the name of Virginia's parents? It was Florence and James. Question number two. In what part of Gateshead was she born? Bertley. I doubt anyone got that one. Unless you live in Gateshead, I doubt you got that one. Question number three. What height was she? She was 5'2". Question number four. How far south of London was Wadhurst, where she lived with her parents? It was 50 miles. Question number five. During the war, which hospital did she work at? It was the Westminster Hospital, where she worked for the Auxiliary Women's Air Force, and eventually, this is just details that you don't really need to know, eventually the hospital got moved to Windsor because of all the bombings in London. But I think there was a bit of an argument with her and her father again. Her father wouldn't allow her to come back. He seems like a bit of a twat. Question number six. On what road was the Victory Cafe? It was Edgware Road. That was a really fascinating bit when I was going through the police files and the court records, and I saw Victory Cafe and I thought, oh, I wonder. Then it was like the same address. And I was like, oh, it's the same address. And then I checked the dates and I went, oh, my God, she would have known Alice. Weird, that, isn't it? So, Virginia murdered, and then a year and a half later, her boss at the Victory Cafe murdered. Question number seven. How many convictions for soliciting did Virginia have? She had four. And question number eight. In what part of London did Mr. and Mrs. Evans live? Mr. and Mrs. Evans. Pimlico. There you go. That was exciting, wasn't it? Ooh, I'm going to go and... I'm not having my kebabs tonight because I'm trying to save money. Got on a bit of a lean patch at the moment. So I will be treating myself to rice and fish and some vegetables. Oh, and then a little bit of school cake. I might do it with custard. Anyway, that's me done. Have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love, and thank you for listening to the podcast. Be good. Bye!
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.